Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Pipeline Things. I think episode 7, this final episode of the arc, really represents an opportunity to change the course of pipeline integrity. Will we learn from the failures of others? I think there's no better place to do that than the area of geohazards. Today, we take you to Hillsboro, where we take a look at a failure due to geohazards and a relatively recent one at that in 2020. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we hope you've enjoyed this arc. All right, welcome to today's episode of Pipeline Things. I am your host, Rhett Dodson, my co-host, Christopher Day Lingle. And yes, I was listening to a podcast this morning, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, and there's one small segment in there, Chris. Fantastic podcast, by the way, where they interview this lady. She says, you know, the great thing about being a host of a show is, like, it's your show. You are the host. No one can tell you what to do.
Is that why you try to take my little dance on episode 6?
I am the host. You need to recognize that.
Well, you know, just remember this, you know, there's people who have ideas and the people that do the
ideas.
This
was your idea, in full fairness.
And there's people that do ideas.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm totally messing with you.
Hey, teamwork makes the dream work, buddy.
You're right.
Teamwork makes the dream
work. So as we get into today's episode, right, today's episode is a much more recent failure, right? So we've been dealing going all the way back to Bellingham. But now we're going to be in 2020 in Hillsboro. That's where we're going. But what's so interesting about this episode, Chris, or so interesting about this failure is I feel like it is, if there is a who's who or what's going on in pipeline integrity, I feel like geohazards is the what's going on in pipeline integrity topic.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's been that way for several years. So one of the most interesting, or I'm going to say humorous and interesting introductions was written by Dave Johnson, who we like to call Dr. Dave.
Dr. Dave.
It's Dr. Dave. It's some Dr. of you Dave. People may or may
if
not.
If you know who Dr. Dave is, raise your hand.
Yeah, there you go. And so some of us people probably know him, some may not, right? So he originally started back whenever he was like Enron's director of pipeline.
VP of Enron.
Yeah. And then when that whole ship imploded, he ended up going and he worked at Energy Transfer,
What
became Energy Transfer, right? And most people knew. I mean, he's like beloved in the industry.
If you were plugged into the industry, like legitimately plugged in some kind of organization that was doing research or anything as an industry, you'd probably met Dr. Dave. Great guy.
So Dr. Dave was like beloved. Great guy. Yeah. I hope he's an avid listener of the show, so you can hear us plug him. He wrote the introduction to the INGA document on the management of geohazards. And I love the introduction. I've used it so many times. I'm going to repeat it here on the show. He says it basically mirrors how the threat of geohazards mirrors how the threat of stress corrosion cracking was in the 70s. Mm. He's like, at first, when it happened, it was like someone else's problem.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry that operator has stress corrosion cracking. He's like, then it turned into a Canadian problem. It was like, it was regionalized where it was like second stage as you realize that, oh, it's the Canadians that have it. Thank God we're south of the border because we don't have this cracking problem that they have it. He's like, the third stage is you have two operators who realize they have the threat and those who just haven't realized that they have the threat yet. And I love that. And he said, in the fourth stage is finally where you get to like a holistic research and growth and maturity in the problem, right?
We have a problem.
Yes, where the industry as a whole begins to coalesce, right? And so, I mean, it took what? God, probably.
That's a really good pun to SEC. Dude, you're on fire.
I'm telling you.
This guy's on fire.
Because I feel like geohazards is the same path. Like if I had to say, I honestly think we're somewhere between probably stage 2 and stage 3, I feel like.
Those guys have it, and I think I might have it as well.
Thank God I don't have pipelines in the Appalachian Mountains.
Yeah, I hope you have data.
Yes.
We'll say that.
Right. Or thank God I'm in Texas where I don't have geohazards, which is a totally errant thought to have happen.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of operators have a growing awareness. You have this broad spectrum of, I'm going to say, geohazard integrity management programs and a growing awareness. But I think still a lot of operators that are, I'm going to say, really either new yeah. or maybe even aren't addressing the geohazard threat.
Well, I could say this. I'm a little bit sad, right?
Why?
Because if you look at the previous six episodes that we've done, I think you've done a pretty good job of story time. And if we look at episode six, the one we just did on Centerville, and this one, the NTSB reports are not very long.
I tell you what,
the story time is coming to an end.
It's really interesting because the like failures...
We've only got two pages.
The failures themselves are significant in terms of what the operators can learn. But I, you know...
Yep.
What do we call him? It's not Miss Producer anymore. I don't know what it is. Do we just call her Miss Sarah?
I feel like I want to call her.
I was chastised for calling her second string Sarah, so I got to come up with a new name now. Yeah. Like,
I like DC. She's
Batman?
No, not DC.
DC Comics?
No.
She's giving you eyes right now. I think we need to abort this conversation and come up with something better. We will come up with a name. We should leave it up to the audience. Audience, if you have suggestions for what we should call second string Sarah /
creative director or
creative director
or Sarah. Sarah.
Yeah, what about just Sarah?
Yeah, so you don't forget the H. Don't forget the H. Okay.
Sarah.
Do not forget the H. Sarah.
We could do like the old biblical thing where she could go from being Sarah to Sarai. Anyway.
Or never in mind. Spanish, you say Sarai. That's an even better one.
She's like, move on, guys. Okay. So going back, it is interesting because the NTSB failure reports did get very skimpy for these last two failures. And I don't know the reasons why. I don't know if it's interesting. I don't know if it's because the NTSB got a hold of them and it turned out that the causes were fairly cut and dry.
Well, yeah, maybe there wasn't a lot to investigate.
Yeah, right? But you don't see any of the discussion around really like ASVs, RSVs, that conversation disappears. You don't see any talk about consequence areas. Like a lot of hot button topics historically, I think, changed. I don't know if that's intentional because they wanted to make them more focused.
Yeah.
I have no idea. But I would tell the audience, you can literally read the Hillsborough failure report in probably 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It's there's not that much there. So I'd encourage you to go take a look at it.
Yeah.
And yes, story time, I don't think is going to be that detailed. So if you sat around the fire and you started it up wanting to listen Rhett tell you a story, it's going to be pretty short. You're going to have a lot of campfire left. So let's get into it. May 4th, 2020, 30-inch interstate natural gas pipeline that's operated by Enbridge ruptures on a hillside location.
Yep.
What makes this story noteworthy is that it wasn't a location that was previously unbeknownst to Enbridge. It wasn't like this popped out of the blue and caught them unawares.
And we got to give them credit, right? Because I mean, I almost feel like this is the second time that's happened with Enbridge, right? Like, when we look at the hard spot failure, same thing, right? Like they knew there was stuff there, right? I mean, so you got to give them kudos in that, you know, they're positioned right. You know, it's just there's just continues to be opportunities for lessons learned. Continue.
I guess that's one way to look at it. I wonder if they'd consider it that way. But basically, the line ruptures in the total cost, no loss of life or fatalities, thank God, $11.7 million in damage. But where the story comes in is Enbridge knew this was a geohazard area. They actually had integrity programs in place to address it. I think that is the surprising thing. And I think it speaks to why... Maybe I have, and my opinions were not formed on the basis of Hillsborough, but I have opinions on geohazards based off of my experiences and my limited schooling. So, you know, most people don't know us. I'm actually a civil engineer working in the field of mechanical. Been that way my whole life. Now, I was structural. Mm-hmm. So I was civil structural, and I very early on got into the field of solid mechanics, which is why I kind of work at the marriage of civil and mechanical. But in every job I've ever had, whether it was at Stress Engineering or with Rosen, people would be like, Rhett was a civil guy. And I'd be like, yeah. And they're like, you had a course in geotechnical? I'm like, I had one course. We called it Fear of Dirt. Because that's about all you learned was that when you're designing in dirt, the answer can be 10 or 10,000 and we don't actually know what it is. And it changes depending on what the water is in the soil. And people would always be like, oh, you need to be our geohazards guy. I'm like, no, I'm not a geohazards guy because I don't know anything about them. And I'm actually afraid. And I feel like you really can't quantify them. So I've always had this healthy fear of dirt, like, because you just don't know what's going to happen. And if you live in Texas long enough, you know that because you see your house cracking over time, right? Like, God willing, this dry spell is probably making God knows how many people's foundations crack to pieces. But anyway.
So that's how you really feel.
That's how I really feel, Chris. I'm afraid of dirt. I'm afraid of dirt.
Hope you know. Do you phone a friend when that situation happens?
Yes. We get the dirt merchant, Alex Kinsey Johnson, and he counsels me when I lay on the couch, if you saw the clip for the Clarion conference. But no, they had detected in an ILI inspection in 2018, mm-hmm. they had confirmed that they had an area of pipeline movement of around 4.2 feet. So the story, in my opinion, really begins around that time. 2018, yep. Enbridge identifies you have a bending strain area. They identify between repeat inspections that it's movement, and they identify that it intersects with a geohazard. So I'm saying right there, you have all the information you know to be concerned, because you have a bending strain area.
Yep.
You have a bending strain area that's changing, and it coincides with a potential geohazard. Like, it's like red flag, red flag, red flag, right?
Yep.
2019, an aerial patrol determines that there's erosion at the right of way, and the ILI indicates additional pipeline movement, and they see ground scarps. So they know things are continuing to change.
Yeah.
After 2018, moving into 2019. In 2020, they determine that it doesn't require urgent action, but they're going to continue to monitor the location and mitigate the identified threat. So what they have planned to do is, and what we're going to do is, we're going to go in there, we're going to install strain gauges, we're going to improve some drainage in the area, because again, in most cases, when you're dealing with geohazards, if you remove the water, some cases, not most, I really shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
If you change the water content, you change the direction of flow, you can mitigate the activity of the geohazard. So that's their plan. Unfortunately, it fails on May 4th before they ever get the chance to implement any of those, right? Mm-hmm. And the basis, I should say, the basis for making that decision in 2020 was that they had estimated the strain capacity in the girth welds was very high. And so they said, hey, look, the strain capacity in this girth weld is really high. We're nowhere near that limit. Therefore, we don't have to take any action.
Yeah.
Obviously, that turns out not to be true. So post-rupture, what they found was that the landslide feature was actually accelerating, right? So if you had based your program on the movement observed between, let's say, 2018 and 2019, that may have been misleading, because the landslide was actually accelerating due to changing soil conditions, right? Which is another important thing. Landslides, just because they're not moving or moving really slow, don't always stay at the same speed.
Yeah.
In addition to that, they found that there were two incomplete penetration and lack of root fusion defects in the girth weld. So the girth weld that ultimately failed turned out to have two defects. And when they accounted for those defects, they found that they had overestimated the strain capacity of the girth weld by a factor of 3. Yeah. Right. So again, if you know, we look at landslides as strain demand and strain capacity, the story here is that the strain capacity of the girth weld was wrong. So their time to failure, what they were basing everything on, was wrong, and they didn't have as much time as they thought. They were much closer to the limit than they thought.
Yeah.
And so they had developed an entire integrity program around that that ended up, you know, obviously based on faulty information. The NTSB didn't, you know, in this report, again, I would say it's pretty bland. They didn't put their normal list of here's what we recommend and have everybody do. What Enbridge did in response was they decide they would use a reduced tensile strain capacity of 0.5%. So that's just, they just took a hard stop at 0.5%, right? And had they had a 0.5%, which is, I would say in most cases, some cases can be already pretty high, they would have triggered a response and this incident wouldn't have happened. But the NTSB concluded that the pre-rupture analysis, which I've already kind of delivered the baby for you, did not appropriately consider uncertainties such as weld defects, changes in the slope and direction of the landslide that it increased the susceptibility of the girth welds, acceleration of the landslide, or the response of these pipelines to factors. Stated basically, you did an analysis to determine that you didn't need to do anything, and that analysis didn't have sufficient safety margins and didn't have an appropriate, you know, estimate of the actual capacity of the weld, which is how we get to the failure we get.
I got a bunch of questions.
Well, I think we're going to take a break before you get into those questions, but I'll say the audience will too, because again, I think geohazards is an emerging field. So this episode is going to be less about the failure and more about where are we at as an industry on geohazards? And what steps, what recommendations do we have the operators to keep this from happening? Hang on and join us again when we get back from the break. All right, welcome back. So we're going to pick up. We're talking about the failure from geohazards and the NTSB report for Hillsborough. And Christopher has pretty much demanded to take over the episode at this point. I think he was offended at my comments earlier in the episode about the host having control.
Oh, no.
And so y'all are just going to witness firsthand the power struggles that go on between the two of us. So
anybody who knows that I have no interest in power.
Chris, I would soft or hard power, because you've told me about this before in both of them.
So you do listen.
I do. Chris, I listen to you when I want to.
Well, you just remember like this kids. Audience, look it up. Hard power, soft power. You got to have the right people in hard power. Otherwise, you'll be in a tight spot. All right. So first question, geohazards, are geohazards a threat to pipeline integrity?
Nah.
That's when you phone a new friend.
Absolutely. And I think you really have to divide them into two categories, right? So I'm just going to do it.
Go ahead.
There's hydrotechnical hazards, which I think a lot of operators probably have more mature programs on. Their water crossings, whatnot. Even at the most recent, the API Cybernetics Conference, Roberto Landazuri from ExxonMobil presented on ExxonMobil's hydrotechnical program. And theirs is extremely developed over the last 10 years, but that was in response to, you know, the Wyoming Yellowstone failure. So those hydrotechnical failures and river crossings, I feel like awareness has risen in the industry on those.
Yeah.
And then there's more traditional, we'd say, onshore geohazard settlement related issues, landslides, those types of things is where I feel like operators are less, you know, I'd say less developed programs. And it's because they always think landslides, because that's the easiest one to convey, Chris. But the reality is it's actually much broader than that. You can have sinkholes that develop. To be honest, you could have things like banks sloughing in water crossings that maybe are intermittent. You could have settlement-related issues and things of that nature.
So it's an integrity threat. So It is absolutely an
integrity threat. So it should be in every operator's plan.
So typically when we think of an assessment, integrity threats, you need to assess them. So you have a plan for assessment. How do you assess for geohazards?
Right. So I think there's two methods. Yep. And Alex McKenzie Johnson and I worked together on this very well. And most people are aware now that we did the Clarion course. Yep. That we did the first iteration of the Clarion course. Yep. It was super well received. Shameless plug. There'll be another version of it.
That was a good idea. Was that your idea?
It was also your idea. So you're responsible for the podcast and the Clarion course. Chris, thank you for your good ideas. You're like idea man.
Is that hard power or soft power?
It's in the middle, it's slushy.
It's
middle power, it's slush power. So we will be doing that course again in January.
So assessments.
But assessments are really grouped into two types. There's what I call surface-based assessments, which can be most cases are based off of LIDAR, foot patrols, let's say boots on the ground type assessment or LIDAR. And those is in identifying known geohazards along your pipeline. So it's creating what we call a geohazards inventory. That's one form of assessment. The other form of the assessment is your assessments based on IMU and bending strain, right? Which again, we've already done episodes on the middle child, which was geometry actually.
Oh, that was so fun though.
But the forgotten technology, which is IMU.
The forgotten. Right? Oh, we've got a lot on this already, We have two episodes, three episodes with the Dirt Merchant. We had Nick Roniger talk about, you know, some of the new regs on extreme events, response to extreme events, and how to do that. Lots of material out there.
And so those are the two methods, Chris. I will say the gold standard, bar none, is both of them together. Operators, usually because of budget, will do one or the other. But if you do one or the other, you're very likely to capture your worst threats. But there have been a number of notable threats, and Alex and I talk about them on the show, where doing only one or the other could lead you to not being able to identify
and
the threat.
And you got right where I wanted to get, which is what I think we find here in this situation, right? So you said it earlier, right? They had performed the bending strain assessment. They had identified pipeline movement and they
had everything.
And they knew it interacted with geohazard. But I want to ask you something, because you said there's two forms of assessments. One is surface-based.
Oh,
is that really an assessment?
No, the surface base has more to do with the identification, right? So there's a component of assessment there that can be in whether or not you have an active geohazard and to what extent it might be active. So like in this case where the surface base fits in is it would have confirmed that what they were seeing in the pipeline was a result of external load. So there's a portion of assessment there. And I would hope, I don't know because the report doesn't get into it, was that there was some indication of how fast or how quickly that landslide might have been moving that probably influenced their decision, right? So what I often look to get when I talk to Alex or when we send people outside, whenever I work with operators that have those surface-based assessments, I need to know the potential for episodic movement.
Yep.
Right. So remember I told you like I'm scared to death of dirt. And the reason I'm scared is because the situations can change instantly.
Yeah.
Right. So and that's really the problem with geohazards is it's not like any other threat for operators. So when you talk about corrosion, we know corrosion grows and we can usually estimate the rate. And if the factors don't change, you can usually assume that rate, as long as nothing else changes, will continue. And that's a safe assumption.
Yeah.
It's not so with geohazards, right? Because your landslide might be moving at this rate today. Then you get one big rainfall or you get a season of rainfall events that change the conditions. The soil properties themselves suddenly change. The underlying clay layer may change. And then, boom, you go from moving maybe an inch every 3 years to 36 inches in a day, right? When the thing just goes. And if you have that potential, it would be like corrosion. You got a 30% corrosion feature that's growing at 5% per year. And then all of a sudden, boom, it grows from 30 to 80% in 2 days. And you're like, what? That doesn't happen in corrosion.
Which is, we're leading right into this, right? So this is great. So you perform an assessment. But as integrity people, we kind of have this compliance mindset and this reference to standards. There's almost a sequence of events, right, that we stick to, right? So you gather information, you identify your risks. You prioritize, you perform assessments.
Yeah.
But when you perform assessment, what happens next? You have to understand your response.
Yeah.
Are there prescriptive responses? I mean, we always talk about 452 for liquids. We talk about 933 for gas or 714 for gas.
No.
What are we doing for geohazards?
Nothing. And this is, I'm going to tell you what. This is, man, you're about to hit on a hot button topic. I think there's two ways. You're going to punch the button. Do we have, you know what, Miss Producer / Miss Aaron Rodgers / Miss Sarai, can you get us a red button that we can hit and we have a red button and the show's like, because this is a red button for me for two reasons, Chris. I want to say that I think this actually ties in several other ways. Mm. I guarantee you Enbridge probably had some consultants that were helping with them. I doubt that they were purely managing this on their own.
Yeah.
And if they were, they had internal consultants and their own internal SMEs. Internal SMEs or external ones always have biases, right? And so I think it is worth noting that bias and things like that probably play a role here, even though the NTSB report doesn't get into it, right? Like
we've talked about that.
I know, right? But goes back to that. You make decisions.
We go all the way from Bellingham where I used the whole point of data integration, right? I was like, data integration. You're like, well, what kind of data integration? It was like, we had previous ILI data that indicated that there was something here we need to integrate. But what would happen?
So
the guy was like, we knew they made a bad call.
I've had a lot of calls like this. And these are some of the hardest questions I get is when I'm talking to an operator and they've got an active area and I know they don't want to dig it or I know they don't want to. And they're like, Red, how much time do I have? And the answer is always like, I can't confidently say, right? Like, I know you want me to tell you that you might have a year. And the truth is, if nothing changes, you have a year. Nothing changes, you might have 10 years.
So before we get there, I want to get back to the question.
I'm getting around to it.
So response.
There's nothing in regulatory right now. And what I keep saying, and I feel like I'm shouting it out.
Because
it's going to come. Like as operators, if we don't respond appropriately and we don't respond, then it's a matter of time until this incident occurs in such a way that forces PHMSA's hand. So this incident didn't. Why? Yeah. Because it happened in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. Nobody was impacted. Yeah. It probably didn't even make the – it probably made the news, but it probably made the news in such a limited sense that nobody – that nobody happened.
Well, you said something. You said that this is a hot topic. Why is this a hot topic?
Because I'll say awareness of geohazards and the prevalence of incidents is increasing.
Yeah.
Right. And now we could go on and on. I choose not to get into if you say, oh, it's due to climate change. I don't know. I can't tell you why they're increasing. Sure. It could be the news cycle is more aware. Like the 24-hour news cycle makes us more aware of when these incidents happen. The prevalence and ability to take out your cell phone and be like, look at this giant fireball in the middle of nowhere from an exploded pipeline. That wouldn't have been around 30 years ago, right, Chris? Yeah. So it could also be just that humanity continues to encroach on pipelines that were previously located.
We're changing the landscape. We're changing the landscape.
We could be changing the landscape. And then, you know, I don't care what the causes of climate change. I want to get into that. Point is, things are changing enough to actually impact pipelines. Could be that they're aging as well. You know, eventually, if it's moving slow enough in enough places for a long enough time, something's going to give, right?
And so, these pipelines have been in the ground in a lot of cases for a very long time.
Yeah.
Or when you install the pipeline, you're moving the earth as well, right? So you've made change to something that maybe was stable. Yeah. So the point is, I think the takeaway is, if you were to look at 933 or 714 you're not going to find a response.
And I think, but I'm going to say now, and I want to put the plug out there. I'm going to tell you my opinion because I thought a lot about this.
Yeah.
If we don't get our geohazard acts together, all operators, right? Not just the big guys. Like Enbridge now has made substantial changes, and I think they learned from this, right? And I'm aware of a lot of the changes that they've made.
Yeah.
Enbridge, in my opinion, has a much more robust geohazards program in light of this. But a lot of operators still don't.
Yeah.
And I asked myself, if this would have happened in a slightly different scenario, maybe with an oil pipeline where they didn't find the leak or didn't find the leak soon enough.
We might have some rulemaking.
And it flowed, I don't know, maybe into a river where it damaged, I don't know, maybe a couple hundred thousand acres worth of wetlands. Like, I don't know, maybe in Louisiana. Then I think the public, people do, when they want to go fishing or alligator hunting.
Yes.
I think at that point, PHMSA's hand will be forced. And what I don't like about that is that in the field of geohazards, it's so difficult because the pipelines don't look the same. Whether you have a vintage pipeline or a new pipeline matters, right? Mm-hmm. What you know about your material properties matters. What you know about the threat itself matters.
Yeah.
And if you have PHMSA come down, they say, you know what? I'm not going to throw it out there again because maybe this is a firebrand. PHMSA comes down and just says, you know what? Every single bending strain call above 0.3%, you're going to dig. Man, we're going to be in a world of hurt, Chris. And that's the type of thing that I think prescriptively PHMSA would do in response to an egregious accident.
Have we seen that before?
Yes.
That's what the whole series is about.
Yes.
Be proactive. So is maybe this a chance to be proactive?
This is a chance to be proactive,
This is a
Chris.
Chance to show we that we've learned our lessons.
We have the chance, Alex and I were saying, to find geohazards before they find us. Yeah. Right now.
So it's like hide and go seek. Were you good at that as a kid?
You know, we used to play Survivor
at
night.
Were you the hider
where we would
or
do it
were you
night?
The one that would go and hunt? Were you the seeker or the hider?
I think I like to be the hider more than the seeker.
I like to seek.
But I don't think I was very good at it.
I like to chase people and watch them gradually get tired. And then you finally, at the end, when they fully quit, that's when you tag them. And you're like, all right, you're it. You watch them suffer a little bit. But anyways, different story. Okay, so liquid. So just again, checking the boxes. There's no response criteria in 452.
Nope.
Okay, got it.
And this isn't, you know, I like how you separate it into liquid and gas regs.
Yeah.
But this is a pipeline issue. Geohazards are the one threat that absolutely does not care what the contents are.
Yeah.
Maybe next to external corrosion, which also doesn't care what the pipeline
contents. Or third-party damage. But then again, the time to delay. But point is, okay, so we've tackled that. You know, one of the things that comes to my mind when you were going through story time, which I needed more. So it's too bad.
There was
not
there, man.
Yeah,
they knew about it. They didn't act.
I needed more story time with Brett. But I will say this. So one of the things I took away from it was you mentioned this component of acceleration.
Yeah.
Right. So you have information in 2018, then you get more information in 2019. You show movement from 4.2 to 5.2. You know there's a geohazard. So the word that comes to me is, you know, you said, hey, they had a response, right? Their response was they were going to mitigate, you know, by managing the water. They were going to put strain gauges. But the word that came to me was conservatism, right? And so you also mentioned the idea of like when you're dealing with the CGR, corrosion growth rate, you know, like we understand that we normally have a handle on that because we have some conservatism to it, whether it's an RPR or, you know, we use a different assessment methodology.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about what's the standard for conservatism when it relates to responding to geohazards, or what's the risk of not of only doing a bending strain and not a surface assessment to understand what level of conservatism you need? What's your reaction?
I think it's really hard to define what the level of conservatism is, because it doesn't come in, honestly, as much on the demand side mm-hmm. as much as the capacity side, right? So the risk you have if you only have a surface-based assessment is you are prioritizing without knowing the pipe's response, right? So it means mm-hmm. a lot of times something that looks really bad on the surface might not be impacting the pipe at all. And I've got mm-hmm. numerous examples. I had one time operator called me in sheer panic because the banks of a bayou had completely collapsed. And I mean, yeah. you look at the photographs and you're like, whoa, that looks bad. Yeah. Turns out the pipeline was buried 15 feet deep and it absolutely did not care that the banks were collapsing at all, right? Yeah. But you look at another location where, to be honest, it may not be visually evident that you have substantial movement. In fact, I'm working on one right now where the evidence wasn't even actually on the right of way. You had to walk left mm-hmm. or right to find the head scarps or the toe of the landslide in order to yeah. know there was something going on. But you had fairly substantial impacts on the pipeline, bending strains north of 0.3 or 0.4%.
Yeah.
So the risk is when you're prioritizing based on a surface-based assessment, you don't actually know what's going on in the pipeline. And so your action is driven without knowing anywhere where the pipeline itself is with respect to its limit.
So conservatism, are you saying that we need to rely on the pipeline assessment potentially through IMU?
Well, the only thing, if you don't have IMU data, you don't have a bending strain assessment, the only thing you can do is just try and mitigate based on what you think your worst landslide is.
Yeah. Assuming we don't have strain gauges on it, right? Yeah. So if you have IMU data, we're running bending strains.
Yep.
Conservatism, what kind of conservatisms we need to apply?
So when we talk about bending strains, you know, I usually talk in terms of green, yellow, red.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so your yellow lights typically start around 0.3% bending strain. That's just where you need to be.
Yeah.
You need to be very careful, right? When you get above 0.4, you're getting into red territory. So like I often tell operators, look, if you've got bending strains above 0.5, you're dealing with like less than 3% of all total bending strain calls that are made. Like you're way out on the spectrum.
Sure.
When you say how much conservative are we? The truth is we usually don't know because we don't know what the quality of the girth welds is. If you're dealing with a new pipeline, a new build pipeline yeah. where you didn't have issues with the girth welds being undermatched, you know, so you had the material properties just sorted out, okay, Chris, then 0.5% may not matter to you at all. You sure. might move along. Be like, you're dealing with a 1940s pipeline where they wanted to get off early on Friday and forgot to make a root pass in the girth weld. You could be in a real warning sign.
What happened here?
This was a Monday, Friday girth weld. Clearly somebody wanted to get off of work early. And so they just, you know, missed the root pass.
Well, that's we don't know what the situation was.
Well, it's two options,
but
right?
We understand.
They either left early on Friday or came back hungover on Monday. That's what we call a Monday, Friday girth welds.
We don't, obviously we're having fun. That is not true, nor do we endorse that statement fully. The idea is we're just joking.
My name is Rhett Dodson, and I do not support the comments made by Rhett Dodson formally on this
yeah.
show.
But I think the point here was there is a component of conservatism we need to address. And right now, the best way that we know to do that is to some degree surface-based assessment related to how often we gather data yeah. is what it sounds like. Be conservative in how often you get data.
And be conservative in what your limits are. If you don't have information to support strains over 0.5%, you need to be very cautious.
Yeah. So if you don't know what's going on in your girth welds, which there may not be a great way to know that,
if you don't,
then you need to be conservative.
Again, I always speak in terms of cause and stability.
Yeah.
This is my guideline to operators. If you don't, if you get a bending strain report and you don't know the cause of the bending strain, your level of concern should go up.
Okay.
If you know the cause, but you don't know whether or not it's stable, your level of concern should go up.
So do I wait for deformation in the pipeline? You know,
no.
So am I using caliper data with data with IMU data?
You have to have a certain amount of hubris to be willing to try and manage on the basis of deformations. And the reason why is, again, you're implying that whatever threat's acting on the pipeline will move at a rate that it will give you a deformation that you can then manage. In reality, it could go and just rip right through the deformation, tear the girth weld, or you could develop cracks in the deformation.
Yeah.
So I'm not a fan. Deformations are useful for maybe confirming whether or not you have a problem. But if you have one, you're already
that
at a point.
That might be too late.
Yeah, you're already at a point. You're not going to call me.
You're at the response.
Yeah, you're not going to call me and me tell you to manage that. I won't do that.
You're going to go do something.
Yeah.
So let's say I have some movement. I have strain. I also believe I have movement.
Yeah.
I'm co-located in a geohazard zone and I just can't get out there immediately. Like I just, I can't physically respond in time to mitigate.
Man, Chris, do really
I
FEA? Tough.
Do I reduce pressure? Like, what would be a natural next step?
I'm going to push back, since you're asking questions. I'm going to put the notes up. I'm going to push back pretty hard, right? So Unless we're talking about fairly low strains, like if we were talking about bending strains of 0.2 or 0.3%, You're going to have to get someone out there, and I'm going to say qualified. So I'm going to refer you to like a GeoSyntec or an Alex McKenzie Johnson. I'm going to tell you, that's the dirt merchant. You better get somebody qualified out there that can write a qualified statement telling you whether or not they think the geohazard's active and what the potential is for it to be episodic.
So at this point, you're focused on the environment, not the pipeline.
If you're trying to ask me for a timeline, because you said you can't get out there.
That's what I'm getting to. I can't get out there to mitigate.
Look, all I'm saying
mitigate.
Is if I do an assessment that has evidence of change.
Yes.
I have no information to tell you how fast that rate might change. You're going to have to get a qualified opinion on it before I tell you don't do anything.
And that will likely be focused on initially on the environment, the geohazard itself.
Because you need to understand exactly what's driving the pipeline. You have to understand that.
And then you would maybe turn to materials?
That would be like, I'm going to use a something that people might understand. That would be like you finding a known area of selective seam weld corrosion. And you asking me, well, Red, I can't get out there right now. Can I get out there in a year? And I'd be like, well, how fast do you think that selective seam weld corrosion is going to grow?
That's a good one.
Right? And you'd be like, I don't know.
You go check the dirt?
Well, no. What I'm saying is we actually do have some ability, more so than selective seam weld corrosion, to characterize the environment. Yeah. And a qualified person may go out there and they may look and they may see the trees butted over, pistol-butted trees. They may look, this landslide's been moving for 40 years.
Yeah.
Absent any environmental changes, we expect it to continue moving slow.
And then you go into damage control, basically.
Yeah, then I could tell the operator, all right, you have some time. If they go out there and they're like, man, it looks like this whole thing has been active. You know, the rainfall has changed. This has been the rainiest season we've had in the last 100 years.
Coming into a rainy season.
Yeah, I'd be like, man, look, all bets are off. Like, I think you actually need to go out there right now. And there's not much I can do to help you
with that. So what role does FEA have in this at all?
So FEA is useful. I've done a lot of level 3 assessments. We're continuing to do a lot of level 3 assessments. They're useful for understanding the response of the pipeline in terms of future mitigations, right? So let's say you go out there, you do excavate the pipeline, you do some stress relief, you install strain gauges, maybe you even install non-native backfill, right? What you still need to know is, how do you know that installing a strain gauges and setting a 500 microstrain limit is appropriate? FEA can help you understand that, right? So it can say, hey, if all things remain the same and we continue to push the pipeline further in this way, then here's how we expect the strains to progress. You shouldn't hit any of your critical limits until X or Y, and that's well beyond where a 500 thing.
So scenario plan.
Yeah, you can scenario plan, basically. It's a good
way. If I need to scenario plan to manage my decisions moving forward, we can phone a friend, leverage some FEA, and help me scenario
plan. And the other benefit is that it can quantify the membrane strains for you. So bending strain only gives you half the equation. The FEA will give you the total strain state in the pipeline. Now, there are tools out there that claim to be able to do the membrane strain, even tools that are claiming they can do the membrane strain.
You
went
right where I was
going to
ask you. I was going to ask you, so what ILI technologies can we leverage for this?
Yeah, so IMU, I mean, you've heard me say it before, you should be running it on everything. That's an easy no-brainer. There are some axial strain tools out there that I think merit operators looking into more.
To ask questions. Get curious.
Ask questions. I think the vendors are making claims that need to be substantiated in terms of their ability to quantify plastic strains in using those technologies for membrane. But again, I do think they potentially have their place, and I think we need to begin evaluating where they fit in terms of their ability, their accuracy, and their ability to be used in things like fitness for service assessments.
Yeah. So if you know you have an area of concern, maybe it's an upgrade, maybe it's a mode of escalation. Right. All right. So, man, we talked about this a lot. So if I want to read more, you know what we always say. One of my big things is it's a lot of the stuff has been documented. It's either been presented. You can find it somewhere, but sometimes you don't always know where to find stuff.
Yes,
what kind of reads would you recommend?
There's lots of really good reads. So obviously, you know, again, shameless plug number 2, the Clarion course is going to be coming back in January.
Okay.
We did get really good reviews from the first round, and we had a lot of participants in the first round of the Clarion course.
Yeah.
So I think Alex and I put a lot of time into that, and we're not going to do it in person next year, but we are looking to do it in person in 2025. So that's one source. Another source is, you know, almost every major conference, whether it's PPIM or IPC, has a geohazards track now.
Yep.
You should definitely consider that. Third thing is that INGA is going to be issuing the updated version of the landslide management document.
Yep.
So that's a good resource. And that's also going to be incorporated into 1187. API RP 1187 is going to be taking the INGA user's guide, the new one, and incorporating it into a standard. So hopefully as that becomes more mainstream, Chris, well, again, we'll hit that goal of finding the geohazards before they find us.
That was awesome. We didn't get story time, but I got them riled up for us.
Golly, man. It's like the hair standing up on the back of my neck. Do you want to close us out? You never closed out. I don't think you've ever closed out the show. Close us out, Chris.
You're the host. Take us home.
You're right. I got to take the host powers back. So again, I want to thank you guys for joining us. Geohazards is something that's very close to my heart. I am very passionate about it. We hope you enjoyed this series on our NTSB failure reports.
Yeah.
I want to encourage the audience out there. Chris and I chose only 7 reports. There's a lot. If you got an incident that you're really passionate about, you think we should cover in future episodes, this has been a pretty good feedback we've gotten on this series. I definitely think we're going to come back around and cover other incidents in the future.
Yeah.
And if you have one that you think we should take a look at, even maybe not inside the United States, we'd love to hear back from you. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of Pipeline Things. And we hope you will join us on our next arc. I am your host, Rhett Dotson. My co-host, Christopher DeLeon, signing off. Thanks.